Thanks for tuning in for the July 14th podcast. I'm Jose Merino, Editor-in-Chief of the Neurology family of journals. This week's first segment features the first part of a two-part series on movement disorder emergencies. In the other segment, you'll hear an interview on steroid-sparing maintenance immunotherapy for MOG-IgG-associated disorder. Please remember that we offer free CME for each eligible podcast. Simply find the Neurology podcast episode online and click on the CME quiz link. We offer up to 60 hours of CME for past shows, all available online. It's easy and free for AAN members.
Hi, this is Jeff Ratliff with Neurology Podcast. For the month of June and July, we decided to produce a couple of primer episodes on neurologic emergencies, acknowledging that many of our listeners are probably moving into some new roles as the academic and fiscal year rolls over. Please listen to last month's two-part episode on status epilepticus with Hallie Alexander and Mike Sperling. For this next two parts, Jason Crowell and I are going to be talking about movement disorder emergencies that you may see in the emergency department. This is going to be part one of a two-part series. For part one, we're going to focus on neurologic emergencies that tend to present with increased tone. And so as I mentioned, I have on the phone with me Jason Crowell, who you all know familiarly from the podcast, who is at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center in Boston. Jason, I guess welcome to the podcast.
Hey, Jeff. Thanks so much. I'm delighted to be here. When I found out that you and I were going to be interviewing each other on movement disorder emergencies, I was reminded of the famous quote by Jerry Garcia of the Grateful Dead, "Somebody has to do something, and it's just incredibly pathetic that it has to be us." I'm kidding. I can only speak for myself. I know there are many other experts out there who know more about this than I do, but I'm happy to be talking about this with you this morning.
I think it's actually a good point that a lot of these movement disorder emergencies, the reality is they're going to be seen by general neurologists who are in the consultant role in the hospital. And by the time they come to the movement disorder specialist, you know, it's possible that a number of neurologists, be it residents or attendings, have already seen these patients. And so we kind of wanted to bring some of the phenomenology and management strategies that we have as movement disorder specialists and sort of arm the residents and practicing neurologists who are on the front line seeing these patients in the more emergent settings. And so I wanted to jump in with a differential diagnosis. Obviously, in this first part, we're talking about essentially someone who presents with stiffness. And when we think about the emergent disorders that present with stiffness, we think about neuroleptic malignant syndrome, serotonin syndrome, Parkinsonism, hyperpyrexia, and malignant catatonia. Jason, can you talk just on the surface about those a little bit?
Yeah, Jeff, you know, as you said, as movement disorder specialists, we tend to see patients who present with very slowly progressive disorders that may present over weeks to months or even years. And so I think one point to make as we start out here is that we should know that these are movement disorder emergencies, right? So we're not talking about stiffness or rigidity and abnormal movements that progress over weeks to months. This is over a much shorter time period. So we're talking about hours to a few days. And another important point to keep in mind here is that we often like to rely on the phenomenology, the movements, to help guide our differential diagnosis. But with these emergencies, you know, as you just said, they can all present with stiffness. And so we really have to think about the totality of the clinical picture of the patient that we're seeing when we're evaluating patients with acute or rapid onset stiffness. And so thinking about things like, is the patient delirious? Is there encephalopathy? Is there dysautonomia? What are the behavioral changes that are accompanying the movement, if any? And so as we go through these different syndromes, it's really paramount to go through the history and be looking for things that might have precipitated the syndrome.
The two that I listed that I think our listeners probably remember back from medical school are neuroleptic malignant syndrome and serotonin syndrome. And we learn about those in med school and early in residency. How can we use phenomenology to help us differentiate between those two disorders?
Yeah, so neuroleptic malignant syndrome is a syndrome of diffuse rigidity and is precipitated by antagonism of dopamine. So this was first described back in the 50s and 60s as a side effect of antipsychotic medications. And it's a syndrome that you want to think about in anyone with a history of exposure to dopamine depleting or blocking medications. And we'll talk about those specific drugs here in just a minute. The classic clinical syndrome for these patients is diffuse rigidity, delirium or encephalopathy, dysautonomia, and a really high fever, and it can present over a day to maybe a few days. typically, classically, the rigidity and the altered mentation happen first, and then you have the dysautonomia later with the fever and tachycardia and labile blood pressure. And obviously, altered mentation can include just fluctuations in levels of alertness or agitation, decreased spontaneous speech. To contrast, serotonin syndrome is another clinical syndrome, and these patients will often come into the ER with altered mental status and maybe a low-grade fever and some muscle stiffness. Again, clinically, these patients present with encephalopathy, agitation, sweating, fever, not unlike the patient that I just discussed with neuroleptic malignant syndrome. But one of the things that's important to note is that patients with serotonin syndrome will often progress much more quickly or abruptly than a patient with neuroleptic malignant syndrome. So we're talking over a few hours to maybe a day. And patients with serotonin syndrome will often have other symptoms that point towards this diagnosis. So specifically things like hyperreflexia and myoclonus and also diarrhea. Myoclonus is especially something to look for and associate with serotonin syndrome, and it's just a nonspecific finding suggesting neuromuscular irritability. You can see it pretty much anywhere in the arms, the legs, the head, the neck, face, or any combination of those locations. But the myoclonus can be tricky, especially if it clusters together into what we call polymini myoclonus, which can appear almost like a tremor at first glance. And so you can see some of this clustering of the myoclonus in the eyes as well, what we would call opsoclonus, manifesting as large amplitude, multidirectional eye movement. So there's a lot of overlap between these two syndromes, but there are a few points to look for to help distinguish.
So there's a lot of overlap in these syndromes. It sounds like neuroleptic malignant syndrome is more classically diffuse rigidity, maybe a bit more of a gradual onset, where the serotonin syndrome is going to come on more quickly, and myoclonus may be sort of that key exam finding that may help you differentiate serotonin syndrome from NMS, or even a polymini myoclonus that makes them look tremulous. And the reflexes can be important too, it sounds like. So both patients are going to be hyperthermic, and the diarrhea as well could help you distinguish serotonin syndrome from neuroleptic malignant syndrome. Given the associated delirium in both situations, I imagine that getting a thorough history can be challenging in the emergent setting, but what are some key history elements that might also help us out when trying to distinguish between these two syndromes?
So the key history when evaluating these disorders is obviously the medication history. You know, this can be tough. It might mean calling a pharmacy or calling family members to get collateral history or looking at their medication bottles if they happen to come with those, because medication exposure is really key. In neuroleptic malignant syndrome, the potential offending drug can include antipsychotics, obviously. So both typical antipsychotics, including haloperidol and chlorpromazine, but also the newer atypical antipsychotics. So clozapine, olanzapine, risperidone, aripiprazole. Also on the list are antiemetics like promethazine or prochlorperazine, and even prokinetic medications for patients with gastroparesis. So metoclopramide is what I'm talking about there. One of the difficulties when thinking about this diagnosis is that the duration of exposure to the medicine prior to the onset of these symptoms can be variable. So classically, most cases occur within 1 or 2 weeks of exposure to the dopamine antagonizing medication, but there's also reports of patients developing neuroleptic malignant syndrome after long exposure to these medicines at even a stable dose. So it can be tricky. Another thing to look for is whether the patient's taking multiple antipsychotics or other medications that you might not think of at first, so things like lithium or serotonin reuptake inhibitors, because those can also be risk factors for neuroleptic malignant syndrome. Serotonin syndrome, on the other hand, is, as the name suggests, a disorder secondary to excessive serotonergic activity. And so obviously the history you're looking for here is one to suggest exposure to multiple serotonergic drugs at some point in the past few weeks. So obviously including SSRIs and SNRIs, but also tricyclic antidepressants, monoamine oxidase inhibitors, lithium, trazodone. There's actually quite a long list of drugs that can be associated with serotonin syndrome, including some drugs that are kind of surprising, like bupropion, which is classically a dopamine norepinephrine reuptake inhibitor, or even antibiotics like linezolid.
And so the medication history is going to be key. Are there any lab tests that can be helpful here?
You know, to distinguish between the two, really there's not. I mean, you're going to be checking labs, obviously, but they're not all that helpful in distinguishing. Both patients with serotonin syndrome and neuroleptic malignant syndrome will have leukocytosis. They'll have elevated CK levels, often over 1,000. They'll have elevated LFTs, but there's really no marker to help distinguish between the two.
And so we've talked about recognizing neuroleptic malignant syndrome and serotonin syndrome and the key in terms of the onset, some of the phenomenology, and obviously the medication history is going to be key. I wanted to transition over to some of the more rare syndromes that can also present with profound stiffness. We mentioned Parkinsonism, hyperpyrexia, as well as malignant catatonia. What are those and how do we recognize those?
Yeah, so Parkinsonism hyperpyrexia syndrome is rare, but it can be life-threatening, so it's important to know about. An easy way to remember Parkinsonism hyperpyrexia syndrome is to think of it as sort of a special subset case of neuroleptic malignant syndrome. So it's also due to depletion of dopamine, but in this population, it's actually due to rapid withdrawal from exogenous dopamine. So the key history here is patients who likely have an existing history of Parkinsonism who abruptly discontinue levodopa or maybe a dopamine agonist at the same time. And then that patient might then develop fever, muscle rigidity, autonomic instability, elevated CK. And clinically, it would really be indistinguishable from a patient presenting with neuroleptic malignant syndrome. And the symptoms can start as soon as 24 hours after the change in medicine, or it can be up to a few days.
I think one thing that we both probably experience as movement disorder specialists is calls associated with our patients getting admitted to the hospital. And it may be that inpatient teams are uncomfortable with Parkinson's medications, or if they're a deep brain stimulation patient, that can present some uncertainty for non-neurologists or non-movement disorder specialists. So what about the importance of continuing a patient's dopaminergic medications when they're admitted? And how about deep brain stimulation? Does that factor in here at all?
Yeah, interestingly, there are reports of patients with deep brain stimulators for Parkinson's disease who experienced a similar syndrome after abruptly stopping their stimulation or reducing their medications after receiving stimulation. So it can be good to check on those patients, perhaps if their DBS needed to be turned off for an MRI or an EKG and wasn't turned back on. And as you mentioned, yes, it's very important for our patients with Parkinson's disease who are admitted to the hospital to make sure that they continue to receive their typical schedule of dopaminergic medication so that, you know, this syndrome isn't induced by a delay or a cessation of their typical levodopa schedule.
Okay, so Parkinsonism hyperpyrexia occurs in patients with an acute exogenous dopamine withdrawal, but NMS happens with dopamine receptor blockade. And syndromically, they're really quite indistinguishable. What about malignant catatonia? I imagine this is also another group of patients who maybe even we suspect NMS because they might have history of antipsychotic medication use. How do we recognize malignant catatonia and differentiate it from what we've talked about so far?
Yeah, it can certainly be challenging because phenotypically, malignant catatonia can resemble neuroleptic malignant syndrome. So fever, rigidity, hyperthermia, autonomic dysfunction, encephalopathy. But in malignant catatonia, there's no history of exposure to dopamine depleting medication. So classically, this is a syndrome that affects young women, and the patients have a history of psychiatric disease, obviously. So bipolar disorder, schizophrenia, major depression. Somewhat different from neuroleptic malignant syndrome, malignant catatonia typically occurs in somewhat of a sequential fashion. So first, there's a prodromal phase with insomnia, anorexia, labile mood swings, so just behavioral changes that can last for 1 to 2 weeks. And then you would have more frank encephalopathy with autonomic dysfunction, hyperthermia, labile blood pressure, tachycardia, sweating, hallucinations, and mutism. And the word catatonia refers to the abnormal postures that these patients can assume. We often refer to that as waxy flexibility when the patient's limbs are passively manipulated into positions, but also many more behavioral changes. So negativism, which is the opposition to any external stimuli, cessation of eating, agitation. And if untreated and this progresses, patients can ultimately end up in coma and experience cardiovascular collapse. As in all the other syndromes we've talked about, the labs are usually not very helpful in distinguishing because you'll see elevated CK, you can see leukocytosis, you can see abnormal liver function tests. So it really doesn't help point you towards one diagnosis than any other.
And I think that's helpful. It sounds like malignant catatonia has that slightly altered prodrome that may help you sort of differentiate it and just kind of reemphasizes again that the history is key in talking to family about how the past, you know, several days or weeks have been for that patient. So now that we are experts on recognizing and distinguishing between these syndromes, what about therapeutics? Are there pitfalls if we get the diagnosis wrong that treatment could be harmful? Or are there principles that kind of apply to treating these diseases or syndromes across all the entities?
You know, in all of these, you really have to keep a broad differential and think about the most common causes. So, of course, checking basic labs to look for metabolic disorders, looking for causes of infection. You know, a patient with sepsis or meningitis could certainly present in a similar fashion with encephalopathy, high fever, and an elevated white count. So apart from basic labs, it'll typically be necessary to do a full workup looking at CSF and also brain imaging. A urine toxicology screen is also helpful to exclude common toxicities. From an acuity standpoint, these are neurologic emergencies. And so often these patients are going to require ICU level care because you're going to be monitoring and treating autonomic dysfunction. So their tachycardia, their blood pressure, replacing volume, monitoring their breathing, cooling them, following kidney function, including monitoring their CK and electrolytes, correcting any acid-base abnormalities. With both neuroleptic malignant syndrome and serotonin syndrome, obviously you want to stop the offending agent. So whether it's a dopamine antagonizing drug in NMS or a serotonergic drug in serotonin syndrome, you want to stop that. And as we've discussed in the case of Parkinsonism hyperpyrexia syndrome, it's really the absence of a drug that's causing their symptoms. So you'll want to resume levodopa as soon as possible, even by nasogastric tube if swallowing is not safe. If a contributor to their dopamine withdrawal is some contraindication to enteric feeding, like a bowel obstruction, for example, you may need to think about parenteral forms of dopamine therapies like apomorphine injections or reticotine patch. With respect to active treatment with medications, whether you're dealing with neuroleptic malignant syndrome, serotonin syndrome, or malignant catatonia, benzodiazepines are typically a pretty good place to start because it can help with agitation. It can also help with muscle rigidity.
Okay, so in NMS, you want to stop the offending agent and consider benzodiazepines. What about giving them dopamine? Initially sounds counterintuitive with someone in a psychotic disorder, but is that ever done or considered?
Yeah, in neuroleptic malignant syndrome, you can think about both amantadine and bromocriptine to increase dopamine. It's probably not going to be a good solution in the long run, but it can help emergently. If there's severe rigidity, hyperthermia, or rhabdomyolysis, you can give IV dantrolene, which is a skeletal muscle relaxant. And typically after a week of removing the offending dopamine antagonist, patients should be improving. But of course, during that time, you'll want to continue supportive care and prevent things like aspiration, deep vein thrombosis, renal failure, things like that.
Are there any special therapies for serotonin syndrome that can try to reverse the effects of excess serotonin stimulation?
Yeah, apart from supportive care and the benzodiazepines, cyproheptadine is often used off-label. So cyproheptadine is an antihistamine, but it also binds to serotonin receptors and helps block the serotonergic effects. Most of these patients do well with stopping the offending agent and supportive care and tend to return back to baseline rather quickly.
And with Parkinsonism hyperpyrexia, principles of restoring the exogenous dopamine medication is key. Anything beyond that?
Yeah, exactly. You want to start their dopaminergics back at the dose that they were taking prior to the onset of all these symptoms. Again, this one can be an emergency. These patients will probably need ICU level supportive care for IV fluids, cooling, benzodiazepines, but there's really not much else besides those steps.
And then finally, finishing off with malignant catatonia, what are the main principles of care here? We talked about ICU level supportive care being needed. Are there specific therapies for malignant catatonia to consider?
You know, supportive care, benzodiazepines. In terms of specific therapies, electroconvulsive therapy is often considered a first-line treatment in these patients. Obviously, this is a conversation you'd be having with your psychiatry colleagues if this were to happen. And of course, one of the things that can make this diagnosis difficult is that often these patients in this scenario are also on neuroleptics. And so you're also actively entertaining the possibility of neuroleptic malignant syndrome as being on the differential. So perhaps stopping any neuroleptics as well needs to be considered given the heavy overlap in these syndromes.
Thanks, Jason. I hope our listeners are feeling better equipped to diagnose, manage these patients when they're presenting with emergent stiffness and rigidity. I think the key here too, perhaps counter to what we tend to think of in movement disorders as a very methodical and perhaps slower approach, is to recognize this differential and initiate supportive care and some sort of muscle relaxing therapy like benzodiazepines, which might buy us some time and help figure out the underlying syndrome and gather some history that might help distinguish these over a little bit more time. So thanks again for joining us, Jason.
Absolutely. Thank you, Jeff.
Thank you. This is Stacey Clardy from the Salt Lake City VA and the University of Utah. Today I'm talking with John Chen. He's a neuro-ophthalmologist at Mayo Clinic Rochester, and he's the lead author on the paper, Steroid-Sparing Maintenance Immunotherapy for MOG IgG-Associated Disorder, published in the journal Neurology this week. Welcome, John, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Stacey. Thanks for having me. Looking forward to chatting with you.
So, John, this is a really timely study. Those of us who treat NMO patients or MOG-associated patients are really hungry for some data to suggest what might be the most effective treatment for the MOG IgG-associated disorder. And so in this paper, you looked at, retrospectively, outcomes of these MOG patients at several different academic centers. And, you know, of course, this is not a randomized prospective placebo-controlled trial, so we won't totally hold you to it. But tell us what you found. What treatment looks to be the best in this study?
Yeah, I think this study was really interesting because, as you said, we don't have much literature there to guide us in our treatments for MOG-associated antibody disorder. And that's because we've only had antibodies against MOG commercially available in the U.S. since the end of 2017. And that's why our group at Mayo, along with multiple collaborators around the country and even some overseas, decided to put our collective knowledge together on all patients with MOG-associated disorder treated with chronic immunotherapy for over 6 months. And so it's one of the largest cohorts to date. We found, interestingly, that the classic medications for NMO, such as rituximab, azathioprine, and mycophenolate, they all led to a decrease in the relapse rate, but many of them still relapsed through these. And these medications didn't appear to be as effective for MOG-associated disorder as they are for classic NMO. One really striking finding is that IVIG given every 3 to 4 weeks seemed to have the largest reduction in relapses. Although we only had 10 patients in the study treated with IVIG, some of these patients had the worst disease. Some of these patients had 2 relapses a year on rituximab, azathioprine, and they broke through all these medications. And then ultimately were started on IVIG every 3 to 4 weeks, and they had complete cessation of the relapses. And so although it's only 10 patients, it was very promising because of that striking reduction in relapses. Right before the COVID-19 pandemic, I was actually in Germany for an NMO MOG meeting where I had a chance to meet with a lot of the international MOG experts. And interestingly, they also found, just anecdotally, that IVIG does seem to be a very effective treatment in preventing relapses for MOG-associated disorder. So it was great to hear that others have a similar experience. And, you know, I think we're going to try and put our collective experience together and prove, or at least demonstrate, that IVIG may be a good treatment. Last thing I wanted to mention is that we actually had 10 patients in the study that were incorrectly diagnosed with multiple sclerosis. And so they were actually treated with the traditional MS medications. And what we found, as others have found, is that these MS medications are not effective in preventing relapses in MOG-associated disorder. And this is important for 2 reasons. First, it highlights that MOG and MS are different entities. They really have different pathogenesis, different treatments. And then second, it just shows the importance of correctly making a diagnosis of MOG-associated disorder. Because if you misdiagnose them with multiple sclerosis and treat them with a medication like Avonox or Rebif or some of these disease-modifying agents, you're not doing them any favors because it's not going to prevent any relapses.
So I know these are small numbers, but for the ones that were misdiagnosed as multiple sclerosis, do you have any clinical pearls to tell us sort of why those patients might have been misdiagnosed? Were they the ones that, for example, only had optic neuritis or something similar to that?
That's a good question. They were a hodgepodge. You know, this was a retrospective study going back before we had the MOG antibody to get some of these longer follow-up periods. So at the time, a lot of these atypical MS patients, if they had a couple white matter lesions, you know, they would put in a bag of MS and be treated as MS, especially the ones that just had recurrent optic neuritis. But now that obviously we have a specific biomarker, we can really tease out some of these atypical forms of MS.
Right. And so your findings are really important because they do suggest a different treatment approach for MOG compared to MS, but also compared to aquaporin 4 positive NMO, right? So you mentioned briefly that the pathophysiology is clearly different between MOG and multiple sclerosis. But what do we know about the differences between aquaporin 4 versus MOG pathophysiology?
Absolutely. These entities are completely different as well. We know that aquaporin 4 antibodies act through complement and they cause astrocytic injury and secondary demyelination. What's interesting about the MOG antibodies is we actually don't even know if these are directly pathogenic. We know they're a good biomarker for this separate disease, this MOG-associated disorder, but we actually don't even know how the pathogenesis works. But before we had these biomarkers, many of these patients actually ended up getting brain biopsies. And our group at Mayo, along with many other groups around the world, have actually looked at some of the brain biopsies and the pathology. And the pathology looks completely different. With aquaporin-4 NMO, we see astrocytic destruction, secondary demyelination. In MOG-associated disorder, we see more of this pattern 2 type demyelination. So the pathophysiology, even at its core, is completely different. And that actually means the treatment's probably going to be different as well.
Right. That's what your work is starting to suggest here. So in your clinical practice, are you now starting everyone on IVIG, or do you still leave any patients untreated and monitor their antibody titers like some groups are doing?
You know, our approach to treating MOG-associated disorders is very different from aquaporin-4 NMO, because if you're positive for aquaporin-4, the disease tends to relapse and the attacks are so severe, they tend to leave severe disability. In contrast with MOG, only 50% of patients relapse. And if you do relapse, the recovery is typically good. So we actually only recommend chronic immunotherapy for patients with relapsing disease from MOG-associated disorder.
So what you're doing then is you would see a patient, they have a first attack, you might monitor, or I mean, maybe if it's optic neuritis, what if it's a really severe first attack? Do you still monitor, or do you go jump right into treatment with that?
Yeah, if it's a single attack with good recovery, we always monitor. There's really not much of a debate there. If they've got a single attack with severe disability, then things get a little bit more difficult. Again, only 50% are going to relapse, so it's frustrating to not know exactly if they're going to relapse. But if they've got severe disability, we might be more likely to treat. And, you know, based on the study, it definitely suggests that IVIG is the best. But because of the cost of IVIG, the requirement of infusions every 4 weeks, we still typically start with rituximab or azathioprine if we are going to have a medication. But if they relapse through these medications, that's when we might turn to monthly IVIG. It's great to know we've got this medication in our back pocket if we need it.
Right. And that was going to be my next question about, are you able to get IVIG approval right off the bat? I'm guessing the answer is not always.
It's tough. You know, it can be tough to get approved right now, especially with the recent shortage of IVIG. I work closely with our neuroimmunologist at Mayo, and we're typically able to get approval, but it depends on the availability of the IVIG, depends on insurance. But hopefully with this research getting published, it'll actually help with getting approval for MOG-associated disorder, especially in these patients with severe relapsing disease that aren't responding to other treatments.
Right, sure. Hopefully it will help. I know in similar conditions, we've sometimes used these papers successfully to, you know, when we have the peer-to-peer, I'm thinking of, for example, neurosarcoid, when we try to get infliximab approved, I often cite one of those papers because there hasn't been a trial. But along those lines, is there a trial in the works with IVIG for MOG or on the horizon somewhere?
I think a trial would be incredibly helpful. And we've been looking into this ever since we had these observations. Unfortunately, these observations came at almost the exact same time as the IVIG shortage in the US. So that's kind of delayed things and made getting a trial up and running more difficult. I think with our international colleagues also finding IVIG very effective, I think this is really the next treatment we'd want to try for a randomized trial, because ultimately that's kind of the answer. And we can have large retrospectives suggesting its efficacy. But until we get that randomized, placebo, double-blinded, controlled trial, we won't know for sure. But I think this is going to be a good medication we're going to want to try.
Right. Unlike aquaporin-4, right, where I guess it hasn't been as promising historically. Again, no randomized trial ever took place of IVIG and aquaporin-4, but it didn't look as promising, yeah.
No, I agree. But with aquaporin-4, it's great. We've got all these other randomized trials showing excellent efficacy for these new medications. So it's very promising there.
Yeah, I guess we should say that. We're recording here on June 12th, and inebilizumab just got FDA approval, right? So now we have eculizumab and inebilizumab, and I think we're waiting imminently to hear about satralizumab from the FDA. So exciting news on that side, but let's step back again. I want to talk terminology, because we are sort of using these terms interchangeably, aquaporin-4, MOG, NMO. So you use in your paper the term, I don't know, do you say MOGAD? M-O-G-A-D, short for myelin oligodendrocyte glycoprotein IgG-associated disorder. And your use of this term is very intentional throughout the paper. So why specifically do you not just say, for example, the MOG subtype of NMO?
you know, the terminology of this entity is constantly evolving, but I think most experts are starting to use the terminology MOG, antibody associated disorder. I think that captures the essence of the disease because, as we talked about earlier, we don't know for sure if these antibodies against MOG are pathogenic, but we know for sure they're a good biomarker. And that's why we have this term MOG, antibody associated disorder. Of course, that's a pretty large mouthful to say over and over again. And so I think MOGAD is just an easier way. It kind of abbreviates it, easy to say, got about the same syllables as NMO.
All right, got it. So not MOGAD, MOGAD. We're going to do MOGAD. All right, you've heard it here first, right?
MOGAD. MOGAD, MOGAD, they both work.
All right. Well, thank you again, John, for taking the time to discuss all aspects of MOG or MOGAD positive neurologic conditions, including NMO, with us.
Absolutely. No, I had a great time chatting with you.
Please take a look at this week's issue. Thank you again for listening and have a great week.
The views and opinions of the participants in this podcast do not necessarily reflect those of the journal Neurology or the AAN. Disclosures of the participants are included in the show descriptions, reached by a link on the neurology.org website.